Kathy Doyle, when I first met you, we were in a conference room, and you were the Kathy Doyle. You were doing this thing with podcasting, and I was just getting into that space, and I was kind of blown away. And we stayed in touch, and now you're the vice president of podcasting for Macmillan Publishers, and you're on Insider Interviews with E.B. Moss. Yippee!
Here I am. I'm so excited. This has been such a long time coming, and I'm delighted to be here, my friend.
Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 31 of Insider Interviews, where you get the insider scoop on the business of media, marketing, and advertising. Now, so much has been changing in the world of podcasting. We've had consolidation. We have a new award show. Do you listen to podcasts that you only subscribe to? Or do you put up with ads in an ad-supported model? There's lots of new shows happening, and I wanted to bring in someone who has been navigating the cross-screen world of podcasting. It's Kathy Doyle, and she's really been instrumental in building out the podcasting division of a book publishing company, Macmillan. She is an expert in so many areas of podcasting. I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. So here's Kathy. Kathy Doyle, in your bio, it says you're the vice president of podcasting for Macmillan Publishers, the only Big Five with a dedicated podcast arm. And I'm wondering what a Big Five is. In my world, it might be like the family pack at KFC. It's probably not that, though.
No, the Big Five represents the most significant major publishing houses: Hachette, Penguin Random House, Macmillan. So we are the only Big Five that actually has its own major podcast network that gets 2.5 million downloads per month.
Wow, that's quite an accomplishment. So was this your vision to bring podcasting to a predominantly print publisher?
It has been our vision to serve our authors the best way possible. And I think, you know, audio emerging the way that it did certainly created an opportunity for us to use podcasting to book publishing in particular's best advantage. It predates me. Macmillan actually went into a joint venture with Mignon Fogarty Grammar Girl back in 2007.
So Mignon is the host of Grammar Girl?
Yes, that's
correct. Right?
Yes.
Okay. And so how did this all sort of gel? What was the evolution?
It's a really fun story, actually. She was a freelance editor in the Silicon Valley back in that day and was finding that her clients were just making the same grammar mistakes over and over again. So very classic coffee shop, paper napkin, you know the drill. She started jotting down some thoughts and had heard about this thing that was emerging called podcasting, where you could record audio and upload it to a feed and distribute it very efficiently. And she said, I'm going to walk the walk here in Silicon Valley, and I'm going to go ahead and create a podcast for my clients. So she did that. And of course, once it was on what was then known as iTunes, it was very public, and there wasn't a lot of podcasts at that time. So it became a hit pretty quickly. You know, she had hundreds of thousands of downloads by the following year. And she started to hear from other subject matter experts who were in her social circles and her professional circles, people coming to her saying, I'd like to get in on the action here. I'm an expert in productivity, or I'm a parenting expert. You know, can I do a show with you? Can I start one of these? And before she knew it, a podcast network had been born, before really that was even a thing. And somewhere in that period of time, one of Macmillan's most renowned editors, John Sterling, picked up the phone and called her, and they started to talk about a book. And both, I think, very quickly recognized this could be something way beyond a book. And very shortly thereafter, Macmillan entered into a joint venture that is still in effect today, 15 years later.
I love the origins for it, being an editor as well. And I think I was an early subscriber and learned fascinating things from Grammar Girl, especially the fact that it's G-R-A-M-M-A-R, not E-R.
A very common error, yes. For sure.
E-R-R-O-R. And so now Macmillan has a pretty big footprint and some nice feathers in its cap. Walk us through how it evolved from the early stage and then how you came into the picture.
Sure. So I joined at the end of 2011. specifically to run the Quick and Dirty Tips Network, our major longstanding podcast network that again started with Grammar Girl. That is a network comprised of, at any given point in time, about 15 weekly subject matter hosted short format shows. We really pioneered the short format podcast. Most of our shows are under 10 minutes. And that has continued to just be a powerhouse for Macmillan. It's a profitable network that does really well with ad sales and is a fantastic platform for surfacing Macmillan authors in a variety of ways, whether that's through an audiobook excerpt or interviews or guest series. It's a fantastic resource for millions of consumers around the world. In 2017, we started a second network because QDT has that reputation and that brand of being quick, short format, subject matter hosted expert content, which really just gives practical advice, you know, how to get red wine out of a white marble table, what's the difference between affect versus effect, and how should I use that in my writing. So we started a second network, Macmillan Podcasts, where we just, you know, ventured outside that format to do everything from biography to true crime to some history to a little bit of politics, and really just started to develop more freeform narrative shows that broke the mold for us and was enabled us to do things that were a little more creative.
You came from some other media companies like the Wall Street Journal and American Lawyer Media. Did you have experience with audio content?
So I like to jokingly say, and it's only half a joke, that I was hired because I knew what a podcast was back in 2011. I had vast experience running digital media properties, primarily web-based at that point. And I'm not joking when I say I was an early adopter of podcasts. And I had been listening for a long time and was very familiar with the QDT shows. So I think that gave me the leg up when I was in conversation with Mary Beth Roche, the president and publisher of Macmillan Audio. And it was funny because at that time, the website was still a very, very significant portion of our business. We run the transcripts of every episode on the website. We do a lot of syndication work. We have an editor who really takes as much time with the web piece of our media as she does with the podcasts. So it's been an evolution. You know, once Serial broke the mold back in 2013, 2014, we really saw a bit of a shift from revenue drivers on the web to revenue with the podcasts.
So I don't know if everybody picked up on that, but you were listening to podcasts before Serial was on the thoughts and minds of everybody else who got into podcasting then.
I blame my husband because he got a puppy without telling me. And I'm a very early riser, always have been. And I started to take on the role of family dog walker at like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And being the multitasker that I am, I was always looking for something to do while I was walking this beast that I came to love. And podcasts were a natural way to pass the time.
Oh, that's great. I love that story. Well, it is a companion, right? You know, so you had the furry companion and the earbud companion.
And believe it or not, I wasn't in the industry at the time. This was like, you know, late 2007, early 2008. But I learned, even just as a listener back then, about missed release dates, you know, about audio quality. Like there were things from just my early listening days that I took with me when I started to run a podcast network.
Oh, that's cool. I talk about the fact that I've worked in a lot of different jobs, and I think that they all come into play to form you as the ultimate executive. So what was your start in media? How did this go? Did it have anything to do with dog walking?
It did not. Okay. My earliest start is kind of a crazy story. If you want to bear with me, I can share it with you. I don't think I've ever talked about it before.
We're all ears.
Okay, so I went to the University of Rhode Island, and as a freshman, I was randomly assigned a roommate, Jennifer Foster, and we are still dear friends to this day. She was a music major. She sang at my wedding, and we both just fell in love with the community there. I'm still very involved. In fact, I'm on the committee now to celebrate the anniversary of my college newspaper's founding 50 years ago. But freshman year, we made a pact. I started it. I said, I want to be selected as the senior commencement speaker. And she said to me, well, okay, game on. I want to be selected as the music student who gets to sing the national anthem at graduation. So we quietly went about our business for 4 years, and that gave me 4 years to write the speech of a lifetime. You know, I kept a notebook because back then, not only was there no internet, but there were no laptops. And every time something interesting happened, I wrote it down. And so sure enough, hard work pays off, and I did get selected. And she did get selected, so we were the only two students on the dais at graduation at University of Rhode Island, and it was an incredible moment for both of us. The day after that speech, I had gone back to the college newspaper offices to clean out my desk, because I had worked there as a student, and the phone rang. And I answered it, thinking it was someone wanting to advertise or whatever, and it was the reporter who had covered the graduation for the NBC affiliate, the TV affiliate in Providence.
Uh-huh.
So she said, we're looking for an entry-level associate producer. I basically had a job in like 2 hours. And I had never really thought about going into TV. I'd been starting to interview with newspapers, but had no idea what I was going to do. And sort of said, okay, well, this is just an opportunity. Let's just try it and see how it works out. So I ended up staying there for several years and rose through the ranks in the newsroom. And it was just an incredible experience. But from there, I left to return to the New York area and go to work at Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal, as an assistant editor, and just found myself really embracing digital, which was emerging at that time, and was put on the team that built and launched WSJ.com in 1996. So that's kind of how it happened. It was a sort of strange trajectory, but always focused on electronic media.
Well, it also speaks to the fact that you set goals, that you have vision, that you're okay at pivoting, and you've got discipline because you get up at 5:30 in the damn morning most times.
You're giving me too much credit, but yes, it was an interesting trajectory. Sometimes luck was involved, and I just feel like lightning really struck twice for me, because I was really involved in the evolution of the internet as a means of consuming information. One of my most fun memories was, not, it wasn't fun at the time, but when I look back now, it's hilarious. The day we launched, one of the co-founders was giving a demo, and the site was already live. And so people were finding it and accessing it. And back then, bandwidth was a huge issue. We were on telephone lines. Yep. And I vividly remember someone running to security to have them make an announcement on the PA system. Everyone get off the internet. Neil is doing a demo. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You know, no. I tell the story a lot about how we went to do a registration form and we didn't have a list of countries to put on what wasn't even called a drop-down list at that point. Like, we really invented some of these things.
Amazing.
So podcasting felt very similar to me in terms of becoming what is not even yet completely mainstream media.
Yeah.
Very analogous to the way the internet was back in 96.
Wild, wild west. Twice in your career now.
Right?
Wow. Wow. That's cool. I love that story. And I would like to share three notes to pay homage to you. Do, do, do. You know what that is?
Yes.
For those who were born after 2000, that would be the dial-up sounds you would
hear. You got it. It's
when the internet was starting.
Absolutely. It's indelible in my memory. Yes, for sure. It is
great.
A sound of the era, for sure.
So what are some of the other striking things that you've seen or been involved with as we've kind of segued from traditional into digital media? Do you have passion areas or gobsmacked about certain things? And we should check with Grammar Girl about how I might spell that if I add that word to the show notes.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how to spell that either. I mean, the thing that comes to mind immediately, and I'm not sure it's the right answer to your question, but I think a lot about the evolution of the host-read ad.
Ooh.
You know, how much...
You're talking my language.
Right? It's still a huge part of our business. And that, of course, for your listeners who might not be as intimate with podcasting as we are, that is when the host actually physically takes a set of copy points and generates an ad that oftentimes must, you know, integrate personal experience with that product or service. So that's been quite challenging over the years. And I can remember a funny story. Back when Mack Weldon got its start, they were advertising on our parenting show.
And we should explain that they specialize in men's underwear.
We had the talking points, and we always, especially back then, we don't do it as much anymore because we do know so much more today and our hosts are so skilled at it. But we would do calls with the agency or the actual sponsor themselves and our ad broker, Midroll, now Stitcher, now SXM, you know, just to get a feel for the campaign and to make sure we understood the goals and the objectives, things we're still very passionate about today. We like to make sure we're delivering, not just for our listeners, but also for our sponsors. So I don't remember who it was from Mack Weldon, but he was in Costco with his kid in his shopping cart, and he was telling our parenting expert to talk about the human anatomy and to curse as much as she possibly could, because that would yield a dramatically positive response to the ad. Now, that was generated from the fact that during those very, very early days, Mack Weldon was primarily advertising on comedy shows where that kind of behavior was acceptable. But a mother of eight is not going to talk about the size of her husband's package in an ad, right? I mean, it just was. So we had to balance how to deliver a strong response while preserving the integrity of our hosts and authors.
So. Yeah, that's always the balance. And one of my future shows, I'll be speaking with the head of Sway, an influencer company. And it's very similar. You know, podcast hosts who are popular are certainly influencers. That is how host read ads are so well leveraged is, you know, it's in the voice of somebody that you have in your ears that you're listening to all the time. So they have a brand that they want to protect. But the advertiser has a product that they want to get their points across. And so where do the lines sort of merge or cross over?
Right? I always call it a giant game of telephone because it starts way back at Procter & Gamble or whatever the consumer goods company is or the startup is. And it's the product manager there who internally within the company decides they're going to invest in a podcast ad. And then it goes through like seven or eight parties before it finally gets down to us and our team, where we massage the talking points, make sure they're genuine and they feel like the host. I mean, all of our hosts are top of their field, highly qualified subject matter experts. We're going to protect them, you know, to the extent we can to make sure that, you know, we're giving them talking points that really match their persona, that can feel genuine and are genuine.
Yeah.
So it's really quite a process. Even though we're really good at it now, you know, we've gotten it down to a complete science, it is still challenging to pull it off well.
Let's talk about some of those shows and let's drop some names. You have some standout shows. You recently won an inaugural AMBY. The AMBY Awards are from a brand new organization, the Podcast Academy, which is great, very illustrious. So drop some names. Tell me about some of your shows and your biggest calling cards and about that award.
So thank you very much for remembering and noticing that. Yes, our Macmillan podcast, Driving the Green Book, which came out last fall, won the award for Best History Podcast. And we were up against some incredible shows, including Slow Burn and Unfinished Deep South, which is a phenomenal show. So we're incredibly honored to have achieved that, one of only 23 shows that received one of those inaugural awards. So yeah, it was a very big moment for us. That was a show hosted by Alvin Hall and Janae Woods Weber, who we sent out on a road trip the summer prior from Detroit to New Orleans. Alvin was part of the last wave of the Great Migration. He grew up in the Deep South. It was a very personal trip for him to travel the Green Book, to drive the same route that Black Americans would have traveled during segregation, during Jim Crow, trying to find safe havens and ways to travel that didn't put the family at risk. And of course, this was all going on while there was so much unrest in our country that the parallels were just unbelievable. It was very emotional and moving for all of us to work on that incredible show. So yeah, that's been out since September, last September.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful show. I have two questions that came out of that. I want to talk to you about how your content, your shows actually get produced, because we did have the producer on a previous episode of Insider Interviews. I'll let you talk about that company and how Macmillan jobs out, if you will. And then I want to talk about how we find and develop content extensions.
Right. So some of the work we do in-house, and then we oftentimes will work with freelance producers. In this particular case, I felt as though Jaleka Lantigo-Williams, the producer you're talking about, was just a perfect fit to work with Alvin and really ensure that those stories were told in a way that was his legacy to some extent, that would do honor to underreported American history stories for generations to come. We felt so strongly about that. So it was a perfect partnership. You know, we were delighted to bring her on. Cedric Wilson, who did the sound design, who did the original score, like her whole team, just absolutely top notch. So it's done on a case-by-case basis.
You know, I'm producing a show now for NATPE,
yes.
The trade association that focuses a lot on content buyers and creators. And it's their first ever show that will bring in podcasting to their historically mostly television conferences and shows, because it's having a moment. This whole intersection of podcasting and TV or video and film is a moment right now. How is Macmillan approaching cross-screen or cross-content proliferation? And will there be plans for, let's say, the Green Book going to another screen?
So we'll see about that. I mean, typically as a book publisher, we don't retain those rights to exploit, but we will certainly support our authors in any of their efforts to bring something to film and TV. I mean, for us, you know, we really focus on just making an incredible podcast. That is our primary focus for my team. And then we also work to enhance discoverability, to your point, by taking elements of the content and exploiting them on other platforms. So for example, we did this well with the Green Book. It was a very wide-scale collaboration with Apple, where we had Alvin put together a list of resources for the book area of Apple, author recommends for people who wanted to deepen their research about the Green Book. We had an incredible musical element to this show, both in terms of time period specific music and then just music that Alvin and Janae listened to on the road. So we put together some musical playlists for Apple. We also did an Apple Map Guide, which was one of the very first, and to my knowledge, the very first podcast tie-in to an Apple Map Guide, which is more of a visual application within Apple Maps where you could feel as though you were along for the ride with Alvin on the trip, you know, point by point. So that was really exciting. So we try to do things like that where we really extend the reach of our shows through, like I said before, syndication. We do a lot of stuff with Scientific American, with Psychology Today, with other platforms where we can put our transcripts or portions of the transcripts onto those platforms in ways that help people discover the podcast. So for us, you know, we're really focused on just making great shows and then to the extent that we can, ensuring that they get into the hands of listeners and, you know, even extend the reach of people who perhaps aren't listening to podcasts, but have a great interest in a topic like social anxiety, which our psychologist has covered so incredibly well over the years, and getting that information out there in a way that people become aware that there's a podcast that focuses and has great content on that topic.
And I love this because it's not just extending the podcast, but clearly it starts with the author, the content originator, if you will. And so you're finding those extensions in an organic and natural way, which it's fantastic. It's what makes my heart beat faster.
Thank
you. I love it.
That's such a good thing to say. And that's at the heart of what we do. You know, as a book publisher, I think we come at podcasting slightly differently than perhaps most of the rest of the industry.
Yes, yes. So Kathy, let's just add a little bit of a future touch to the end of our time here. What do you think is ultimately the next iteration of podcasting? Let's start with your monetization hat, because we all know, most of us, that there are more than 2 million podcasts out there, even if only, you know, call it 750,000 of them are active. But that's a lot of competition for ears and for ad dollars. And then we are balancing that with a lot more subscription options. So thoughts about any of that?
Yeah, it keeps me up at night sometimes. I think it keeps a lot of us in this industry up at night a lot of the time. Revenue diversification is something we talk about a lot. In fact, you know, we just did this panel with Digital Hollywood where we talked about revenue diversification with people like Jenna Weiss-Berman and Jen Sargent from Wondery and Steve Wilson. It's, you can't just rely on the ad model anymore. You have to find ways, whether it's exploiting a podcast into a book or a film and TV. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see how podcasters leverage these new tools that are available now through Spotify and through Apple and have been available through Stitcher and Luminary and some of the other platforms out there. But, you know, really being strategic about your content, about your development, and then finding ways to expand and enhance that through a premium subscription, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said absolutely not. But now I think there's probably opportunity for that. And certainly, I listened to some shows this week where there was 3 mid-rolls. That's a lot of ad inventory in a show. So as people expand their listening and really become hooked on some shows that have that kind of ad load, I think, you know, spending a few bucks for a premium subscription to eliminate that might be very attractive.
Agree. And, you know, for those who are interested in supporting Insider Interviews and you like this, I've taken to accepting tips through, you know, a little platform called buymeacoffee.com, /Moss Appeal. But, you know, I'm just dipping my toes in that option. I never pursued an ad model for this podcast because it's really about sharing out good content. So there are all kinds of approaches, whether it's buymeacoffee.com or Patreon, subscription, ad supported. What do you think about all the contraction going on in the industry? Do you think that there will be just a few standing, or is podcasting about to have an even bigger moment?
It's a really good question and a hard question. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's my job.
You know, I think last year was definitely the year of consolidation. We saw so many big deals go down, you know, certainly Wondery and Amazon and The Ringer and Joe Rogan and some major podcasters going exclusive with some platforms. So I think in some ways we haven't seen the last of that. I think there's a few more big acquisitions to be had. Again, for us, we're kind of just nose to the grindstone. Let's just keep doing what we've been doing. It's working. Let's try to extend that to the extent possible. And let's really be strategic about the ways that we're using our platform and our owned media to benefit the greater good of Macmillan. That's, you know, I have no choice but to sort of stay in my lane from that perspective and just stay really focused on what I know we can do for our organization. Kind of a cop-out of an answer, I'm sorry, but
well,
those are complicated, thorny issues, and, you know.
And nobody has a crystal ball, so
yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Kathy, at the Digital Hollywood session that you did, and I think we can add a link to that, Victor Harwood puts on tremendous conferences, and you led a masterful dream team of podcasters. I hope to only do as well with some of them on Content Cast on July 14th. Little plug for that. But the last question you asked some of those folks was their favorite podcast, whether it was from their own company or not. So I'm going to put you in the hot seat and ask you.
I'm so glad you asked me that question, because just this morning I listened to something that I've been really anticipating since I read it was coming, which is Max Linsky's 70 Over 70 podcast from Pineapple Street.
Love the concept.
Yeah, so Max is one of the co-founders with, again, Jenna Weiss-Berman. They do some of the best shows in the industry. You know, Missing Richard Simmons, I mean, the list goes on and on. Winds of Change just won a lot of awards, too, at the Ambies. So anyway, Max is going to do interviews with 70 people over the age of 70 to share their wisdom about what life is like in sort of those later stages. He's talking to everybody from Dan Rather to Madeleine Albright, his father, lots of different people. But the trailer and the early episode I listened to were just incredible. And it made me really excited, because I think sometimes you listen and a lot of stuff can start to sound the same. I just thought this was a great example and reminds us that there are still some very original concepts out there that we as an industry can develop and build as we continue to grow this business into what is now anticipated to be a $2 billion business by the, 2023, I think.
Yeah. Great example. And it also embraces people of all ages and reflects the increasing number of older Americans listening to podcasts. It's so good for so many reasons. And thank you for bringing that up.
You know what? It's so important that you said that, because one of the things that Jenna has been saying is that part of their focus is to build shows that bring people in to listen. And I just thought, you know, yet again, another example of someone walking the walk, right? They're doing it. So it was, I just thought it was great.
Well, Kathy, I will let you get back to walking the dog.
It's too late in the day. I can't do it now.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you so much. EB, this was such a smart conversation. I really appreciate everything you do, and your show is great. And I will buy you a cup of coffee, and I hope all of your listeners will as well. So we've been great friends. I don't remember the meeting in the conference room you talked about. I do remember going out to lunch with you very early on when we were still in the Flatiron Building, and that probably was, God, at least 5 or 6 years ago. It's been a while.
And I was gobsmacked having lunch with you then.
There you go. It was really fun. We'll have to do it again when I get back into the city.
Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.